I think we're just about ready to introduce the world famous. I've said this is the most famous, world famous presentation on the history of Hopewell anywhere, right? Well, you couldn't get a better one. So it's my pleasure to welcome you tonight to Hopewell Reformed Church. I know we have some folks who are here not to hear our usual preacher, but to hear another preacher tonight. So without any further ado, it's a pleasure to have you here. It's a pleasure to have George here. And it's a pleasure to have Charlotte here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. God bless you in this.
I would like to just explain why I wrote this paper. I belong to what is called the Wednesday Club. And for a membership in this club, you have to agree to write a paper once a year. For 25 years, I did this. After you're in it for 25 years, you don't have to do it anymore. All you do is go and... I think they feel they've heard enough of you. And all you do then is just go and eat and have a good time. So anyway, this was done for the Wednesday Club. The Wednesday Club is celebrating their 100th birthday this year, and this club has been in continuous operation all that time. It started in Fishkill Plains and Hopewell, and it is only 25 people because that's all that can meet in the homes. But it is a fun thing, and I enjoy it very much. Anyway, I wrote on Hopewell Junction in 1923. The year is 1923. As my story unfolds, I am a young girl who has spent the first 10 years of her life living happy. Now, I know you all have figured out how old I am. But I'd like you to know right now that you are wrong. I really am only 78. I mean 88. I mean 87. But you all think I'm 88. But my birthday is not until October. So don't push me. All right. I've been living happy and contented in the village of Hopewell Junction, so called because of the junction of two railroad lines, the Central New England and the New York, New Haven, and Hartford. It is a busy and important railroad town with a smattering of small businesses and farms. It is my world. I really know little of any other. To me, it is an exciting place with all of its many big black trains, the clatter of the wheels on the tracks, the steam, the whistles. I wasn't concerned with the soot from these engines, which caused despair for my mother as she surveyed the wash on the line. Nor did I have any fear of the occasional hobos who rode the rails when they stopped at the house and asked for work in exchange for a meal. The unpainted buildings of the town did not appear unattractive to me. Life was uncomplicated, and except for an occasional fist fights with school kids, which usually, among the girls anyway, resulted in agonizing hair pulling, kicks and punches. We swam at Larry's Creek in the summer, ice skated at Borden's Pond in the winter, and we sledded on any hill we could find. Even in the roads, as there was little traffic, there was a very nice hill where the Grand Union is today. If we could extend our ride by going through someone's yard, we did that. Everyone knew everyone else. I was loved and happy. On this day, in the year 1923, I leave my house to stop down the walk, pausing at its end to await the arrival of my friends, Ruth, Lee, and Marie. As I scuff my shoes in the dirt road, my gaze goes across the street to the farmhouse of my grandmother, now the McCool Funeral Home, where I see my mother and my aunt and my grandmother sitting on the front porch enjoying the customary afternoon chat. My Uncle Larry, who runs the farm, is walking out to the old Dutch barn, probably to get the stanchions ready for the return of the cows from the creek and the pasture. As I glance down the hill, I notice that our neighbor, Mrs. Norman Cole, is out welcoming her guests, the Wednesday Club ladies, who have come down donned in their hats and their gloves for their literary meeting and social life and refreshments. I also see my friends approaching and eagerly await the beginning of our favorite walk, which is planned for the day, the circle or square that comprises Hopewell Junction. As I join the girls, we continue up the road, passing on our right the home of Howard Stevens, proprietor of Stevens' store. Mr. Stevens was in later years to meet his death in a tragic way. It was the 4th of July, and he and Mrs. Stevens had gone fishing, where he apparently suffered a heart attack, fell out of the boat, and drowned in a few feet of water. Next to the Stevens house was an old orchard belonging to our farm, which contained a few old apple trees. Those trees produced very early yellow apples that were such a treat after the drought of the winter and summer with no apples. The trees were also good for climbing. Beyond the orchard was Coleman's Red Onion Hotel and Bar. Red, because that was its color. Onion, I know not why. The house burned in later years, the cause unknown, but many a fire was caused by embers flying from the engines. It was a marvel of the time that Mrs. Coleman's diamond ring was found in the ashes. As we approach the railroad track, we are stopped by Mr. Wenzel, who is the guardian of the tracks. He has come out of his little shed with a paddle with the word stop on one side showing, and the opposite side reads go, which he exhibits when the track is clear. Some days we argue with this man, saying that we can beat that train that's coming, be it known that if one got stuck by one of these long freight trains, it could be a lengthy wait, as there were many cars on the freights, sometimes numbering over 100. With an extra engine in the rear or a double engine in the front to help either push or pull the train over to Pauling Mountain. Today, as usual, we wave to the engineer in the engine and again to the flagman in the caboose. We also have to wait for a little hand car, which was being pumped along the tracks by the workmen who prepare the switches and so forth. Safely across the rails, we note a railroad freight building, and next to it, Cupetz's lunchroom, which we rarely enter. The large building across the street we gave wide berth to, fearing we might meet up with someone who had been in the bar. It was a hotel also, run by Mr. Foxy Turner and assisted by his maiden daughter, Annie. Little did we realize that Annie would, during the World War II, keep a jar on the counter urging donations for the soldiers. Not a boy from Hopewell who was in the service failed to receive a gift of cigarettes, candy, and sundries from her. We now turn to the right, glancing as we do so at the firehouse located on the corner. It has a large iron ring mounted outside, which is struck to announce a fire. The train whistles also blow special warnings to announcing that there is a fire too, perhaps one long and two short toots. To find the exact location of a fire was a very simple thing to do. All you had to do was to ring up Central, who was the operator. We called her Central. All of the buildings adjoining the railroad tracks were demolished when the overhead bridge was put in 1935. And just before that, that was completely flat there. So that it was very different with that hill. The only house on the right and still perched up there today was owned by the Whalens. A scene in that house will always remain with me. The mother of the family had died, leaving five children. My grandmother was going to go to pay her respects, and it was decided, since Catherine, one of the daughters, was in my class at school and a friend of mine, that I should go too. It was with fear and trepidation that I approached the casket to see my first dead person. Mr. Whalen had unusual nicknames for his children. Box was Francis, Stub was James, Croc was Catherine, Hud was Helen, and Bottle was John. How he arrived at these nicknames was unknown, but these nicknames were what they were called. We cross more tracks, no watchman here, and come to the station where my Uncle Sam, Marie's father, is the station agent. The station is not busy or bustling today, as a passenger train has just not long ago left for Poughkeepsie. We snoop around a bit, checking the rows of tickets, the ladies' room, and avoid the spittoons. Our next stop is the post office, which is a building in a row of houses. It is a pretty active place, as every one in town picks up their mail there. As we enter, we are faced with a whole wall of boxes. Opening ours, we pick up any mail and proceed on our way. We note that the Hopewell Inn is flourishing. This is also out of bound place to us. Directly across is Borden's Creamery, where Ruth and Lee's father works. So we are welcomed there. We encounter the unique odors of warm milk, ice, and sawdust. We are happy to receive a sliver of ice to munch on as we proceed on our way. We stop across the street at the Stevens store to pick up a loaf of bread, which my mother has requested. Mr. Stevens is busy filling orders to be delivered, orders he has solicited by a personal call on the telephone. The store is rather dark inside, with oiled wooden floors, dark walls and counters. It's no supermarket. There is a lot of merchandise, though, in the store. On one side is the food market. Canned goods, eggs, butter, bread. The other side is the clothing, including shoes and artics and boots. Across the road again, we go to check out the feed and cold plant of my grandfather. He has died the year before, but I can still visualize him seated at the roll top desk, working on his accounts, a pipe in his mouth. The bin of feed and seed are fun to run your hands through, and the big wooden scale outside, flush with the ground, so that the wagons and trucks with their coal can be pulled up on it and be weighed, is one of life's marvels to me, since the weight registry is inside the office. I puff up with pride that my grandfather has such a wonderful invention. Passing the sheds and the duck pond, we come to Burtis's Hotel and Basement Bar. There is a pathway between the buildings and the pond, which leads to another pond, which is where Borden's Creamery gets their ice in the winter. We never ask permission to cut through Burtis's yard. It seemed to be a long-standing tradition, the same as flying through Bates Yard on Orchard Street on a sled, sliding under the fence and ending up in the Wintermute's yard. Adults were kind and generous to us, and we were pretty good and well-behaved children, except perhaps at Halloween, when a privy at the schoolyard was usually upset. Our good behavior was in part due to everyone knowing everyone who you were, and the fact that anything that you did wrong could easily be reported to your parents. Crossing the tracks for the fourth time, we hear no whistle announcing a train. The roundhouse is off on the left. We don't usually go there, the big noisy engines are too intimidating, and perhaps we aren't receiving too great a welcome from the workmen, because the roundhouse was the train's hospital. We do stop at Mr. Grumbly's store, however, where we have the change from the bread to spren. Mr. Grumbly was a bachelor of undisclosed age, somewhat of a recluse. He wore a wig held on by rubber bands cut from an inner tube. He had an ice cream fountain in the store with typical ice cream tables and chairs. He also sold magazines and newspapers. In the front of the store was a wonderful counter of penny candy. If I had a nickel to spend, it invariably went for a roll of Necco wafers. I especially liked the chocolate ones and always hoped it would be my turn when one of those appeared. There also was a gasoline tank outside this store. Mary Heaney upset it one time, and someone else got on fire when a lighted match was thrown into a pool of spilled gas. Mr. Grumbly saved his pennies, dumping them in a room upstairs. When he died, there were hundreds of pennies in the room. A barber shop was housed in the rear addition of the store and had its own entrance. Mr. Grumbly also had a grocery store built next door. At the time of our walk, it housed the King's Market, our first chain store. It was followed later by the Schaefer store in 1927, run by Mr. and Mrs. McKeel. She is now Lula Knickerbocker. Her children, Louis McKeel and Myra Ross, all three are still living in Hopewell. Sadly, that is not true anymore. None of them are living. The tiny building across the way, and that's that little teeny house, was perhaps a barber shop or maybe a shoe repair shop. We didn't stop there, so we don't know what was there. Ahead is one of our very favorite shops, the blacksmith, run by a Mr. Pascoe, George Bailey's grandfather. What a fascinating place. The stamping of the horses, the switching of their tails, the hot fire pumped up by the bellows till it was fiery red, the pounding of the anvil, and the hissing of the hot iron as it is dumped into water to cool and to harden. And then the mystery of nailing the shoe on the horse's hoof, and he didn't even whimper or cry. We didn't bother with the two bars across the street. And do you think there are quite a lot of bars in Hopewell? And we didn't even bother stopping in at Dan Lynch's meat market, although he was a very nice man. It was getting late, and we were due home shortly. Cy Tompkins' store was on the corner. That was the corner of now 82 and 376. He had the well-known reputation of not being too generous, wrapping all of his sales in newspaper. He carried groceries as well as notions thread, buttons, a bit of yard goods. I was often asked by my grandmother to run down to the store for some item, and I was always glad to hear her say, "And keep the change." Cy, too, had a counter of penny candies. The Episcopal Church, now Frankie's, across the road, is not our church, so we ignore it. But the Emmeline Hall, now owned by the Dutch Reformed Church, is familiar, a familiar spot, and being our denomination. There is a supper planned for that night in the basement, which houses the dining room and the kitchen. Ladies are bustling around, setting the tables. The upstairs of the hall is used for various activities, Sunday night church services, silent movies with Mr. Mills playing the piano, basketball games, plus Christmas programs and so forth. When an addition, a long room and a stage in the kitchen, was put on the church, Emmeline Hall was sold to the Catholic Church. We passed the parsonage, and this was the parsonage for the Dutch Church, which is right next to what is the antique shop now there. And that was where the Frys lived when they first came here. And Mrs. Fry just loved that house. They had just been married, and it was their first home, I think. And she, to this day, really speaks of that place with loving thoughts. As we pass the parsonage, Mrs. Cole's Wednesday Club friends seem to be leaving. In fact, some are having to wait for Uncle Larry's cows to journey up from journey up the road from the pasture to the lane and eventually the barn. It is often my chore to lend a hand at guiding the cows or to stop the traffic. Of course, stopping the traffic was a big deal. There were probably one or two cars lined up. It's kind of different today. I would hate to do that. I leave the girls at Marie's house, which is across from Mrs. Cole's, and proceed on home. It is almost time for supper. I hope we will have fried potatoes. I sure love potatoes. So this was Hopewell Junction in 1923, and to me, it was just like Lake Wobegon, where, quote, all the men are smart, all the women good-looking, and all the children are above average. And I ended this with a thank you to George Bailey, Mary and Bill, Myra and Bill Ross, Mary Heaney, Marie Lesher, for sharing their memories with me. And I, at this time, would like to thank Tracy Shankman for copying this paper for me in this lovely big print, which I seem to be having still trouble reading. But I do thank you, Tracy, very much. Tracy is a member of this church, and I didn't know her at all, and she just said, "I'll make that bigger for you," and she did a nice job. I thank you. Now, George, but I forgot to say if anybody had any questions about your pictures to interrupt at any time. Sorry about that. But I also thought of, Taylor breathing down my neck here. not getting this done in time. So there you are.